This is But Why, a podcast for curious kids from Vermont Public Radio. I'm Jane Lindholm, the host and creator of this show. If you haven't heard But Why before, let me explain. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode where we answer questions from kids all over the world on anything they're curious about. Really, anything. In more than 100 episodes, we've answered questions about how babies are made, why flamingos stand on one leg, what the end of the world might feel like, whether or not there are underground cities, why it itches when you get a mosquito bite, what makes tape sticky, and why Americans call soccer, soccer, when the rest of the world calls it football. I could go on, but that would take up the whole hour. We have received more than 5,000 questions since Melody Baudet and I started this show 3.5 years ago, and we've heard from kids in all 50 U.S. states and 59 different countries. If you are a kid and you have a question for us, or if you're an adult listening who thinks they might have a kid who might have a question for us, have an adult record the kid asking the question and then send it to questions@butwhykids.org. You can find all of our episodes at butwhykids.org, so that's where you can learn more about how to listen as well. But today, sit back and relax. We're bringing two of our episodes to the radio. Later in this hour, we'll be learning about the dark and fear of the dark. But first, we're going to turn our curiosity to noodles. Yep, noodles.
Hi, my name is Hugo. I'm 4 years old, and I live in Burlington, Vermont. And my question is, how are noodles made?
I want to show you how to make hand pull noodle, fresh pasta.
That's Martin Yan. He's a famous chef who grew up in China and now lives in San Francisco, when he's not traveling all over the world giving cooking demonstrations and judging competitions. He also hosts a show on public television called Yan Can Cook. And among the many restaurants he owns is one called MY China in San Francisco's Chinatown. So that's where we went to get an answer to Hugo's question.
How are noodles made?
Martin Yan works with an executive chef named Tony Wu. And one of Chef Tony Wu's specialties is that he can make noodles by hand without any machine that are nearly as thin as your individual strands of hair. Okay, maybe not quite that thin, but very, very thin strands of pasta. This is really difficult to do, and it takes both talent and years of practice. But here's how Martin Yan describes his noodle-pulling executive chef.
This is a noodle machine. Human noodle machine. Human noodle machine is my dear friend, Chef Tony Wu. He has been making fresh pasta when he was a young kid in China, and now he's a true master. In less than 2 minutes, he can turn one piece of dough into 16,000 strands of noodle. That's how much he can do.
So when you say he can turn one piece of dough into 16,000 noodles, you're not kidding. It really is 16,000.
Not only that, he does it blindfolded. You have never seen it before.
Now, I know you can't actually see what's happening here, but Martin Yan is going to describe it for us while Chef Tony takes one lump of dough and turns it into 16,000 strands of noodles. Why does he do it blindfolded? Well, actually, I don't really know. I think it's just for fun and to show off how good he is at making noodles that he doesn't even need to look at what he's doing.
So explain what he's doing. You may have been able to hear something that sounded like somebody was slamming something on a table. Yeah. So what's happening?
We're blending these wonderful noodle dough in the table, on the table, because you want to beat the gluten. So when you pull the noodle, they won't break.
You might remember from our bread baking episode that gluten is a set of proteins, structures that occur naturally in wheat that give bread and pasta their stretchiness. So by beating the gluten, you get it to line up so that the dough will stretch when Chef Tony pulls it instead of snapping in two.
That's why it bang the noodle and twist the noodle and bang, bang the noodle makes a lot of interesting noise.
So it almost looks like he's kind of turning a piece of dough into a jump rope.
He can actually jump. Of course, you know, we don't want to encourage people to jump rope just in case it fell down on the floor. Then you cannot eat the noodles. Waste it. You don't want to waste it. But basically, Chef Tony is going to show us how to make noodle without machine. Because he is a...
You know what's coming.
Human pasta machine.
But wait, before Chef Tony turns one lump of dough into many individual strands, let's back up a little bit. Do you know what a noodle is made of? We called up a woman who spent a couple of years just researching noodles and the history of noodles from China to Italy and everywhere in between. Her name is Jen Lin Lu, and she wrote a book called On the Noodle Road, From Beijing to Rome with Love and Pasta. I called her up on Skype in Beijing, China, where she runs a cooking school called Black Sesame Kitchen.
Noodles or pasta are basically made with flour and water. In Italy, sometimes they use eggs to substitute for the water, but generally it's just flour and water.
Sometimes do you use ingredients other than flour? Rice, for example?
You know, in Chinese culture, those are not considered noodles. They're actually considered a different kind of food. So basically, the Chinese word for noodles or pasta is mian, and mian needs to have flour in it.
So what is the definition of noodle then?
Well, in Chinese culture and also Italian culture, noodles are basically sheets of dough made from flour and water, or eggs in the case of Italy, that are pressed into various shapes. So noodles you would commonly think of as long and stringy, but actually they can take many, many different forms in both Chinese and Italian culture.
But when did they get invented? We always get questions from you about when things were invented and who did it. And that's one of the things that Jen Lin Lu wanted to find out, too, when she was researching her book. But discovering the truth wasn't easy.
Well, it was really hard for me to pin down exactly when they were invented, but I did find some sources in Chinese history books that did place the first mention of noodles somewhere around the 3rd century BC, which means, I guess, about 2,300 years ago.
Did noodles then look the same as noodles now? I mean, are the early noodles what we would be familiar with today?
Well, since we don't have any pictures, we don't really know what they look like. But from the descriptions, they do seem like they're fairly similar.
How did they then get to Italy, where people also associate a big culture of noodles?
It looks like probably what happened was they were invented in China and they were also invented somewhere in the Middle East a little bit later, probably a few hundred years later. And that there were two parallel cultures of noodles that developed separately. And then because of the interactions between cultures later on, they started merging. And so they were probably eating noodles both in Italy and China at separate times, and that they didn't really have much to do with each other in the beginning.
So you think they arrived in Italy through the Middle East rather than through China?
That's right. It seems like the Italians learned about the culture of noodles through the Middle East rather than China.
There's a story that sometimes gets told that an Italian explorer and trader named Marco Polo discovered noodles in China when he was traveling there in the 1200s, and then he was the one who brought them back to Italy, and that's how Italians started making pasta. But from her research, Jen Lin Lu thinks there's no possible way Marco Polo was the one to bring noodles or pasta from Asia back to Europe. The evidence suggests that Europeans were already eating noodles by that time, and they probably got their noodle culture from the Middle East instead of China. And in some ways, it doesn't really matter where noodles came from, because each culture has adopted its own recipes and methods, and its own culture around food and noodles.
I mean, I took a trip all the way from Beijing to Rome on the Silk Road, basically to follow the noodle, to see how it changed along the way, and all the way from China through Central Asia. I went through Iran, I went through Turkey, through the Mediterranean to Italy. There were noodles all along that path. And I just found it absolutely fascinating that every culture had a different kind of sauce for their noodles or some kind of soup that they used. Noodles seemed to be sort of a comfort food for so many cultures.
Were there any traditions of how you're supposed to eat noodles in any of the countries that you researched and traveled through?
Yeah, I mean, in many cultures along the way, including China, they do a dish that's sort of an offshoot of noodles, dumplings. Chinese dumplings, of course, are often made at Chinese New Year. We found this a similar thing with a similar dumpling in Turkey called manti. And they are made usually on a weekend afternoon with the female members of the family. And there's also, you know, the more talented you are in a Turkish family, the smaller you can, you know, you can wrap really tiny, tiny Monty dumplings. And then, of course, in Italy, there's a big tortellini culture. And that is often a dish that old nonnas, grandmas in Italian culture will make for their families.
Back in Chinatown in San Francisco, Martin Yan says noodles can be both functional and important for cultural heritage.
In Western cuisine, there's not as much symbolic meanings about noodles. So noodles are very, very functional because you can put anything topping on top. And people around the world using noodle to make noodle soup, to stir-fry noodle, pan-fry noodle, noodle pancake, all kind of way to make noodles. So noodle is also the symbol, because noodle is long. So noodle is also a symbol of long-lasting relationship, longevity, long life, because long noodle. When we eat noodle, you think about history, you think about tradition, you think about cultural differences. So there's a lot of things that you can learn by eating, because food is history, food is heritage, food is tradition.
Writer Jen Lin Liu in Beijing says her connection to noodles feels very personal.
As a Chinese American, as somebody with Chinese heritage who was born and raised in the United States, I could really relate to the noodle because, you know, it's something that's both Asian and Western, and it's got, you know, sort of a different personality to it. So I found that I could really kind of connect with the noodle because it really did represent East and West.
Lots of cultures have noodle traditions and distinct noodle dishes, from ramen in Japan to kugel in European, Israeli, and American Jewish communities, laksa in Malaysia, spätzle in Germany and Austria, Persian reshte, even macaroni casserole in the United States. Maybe your family has a special noodle dish that is meaningful just to you. This might sound gross today, but when I was a kid back in the 1980s, the special birthday meal that I got to have just once a year was macaroni and cheese from a box, you know, the really yellowy orange kind, with cut-up hot dogs in it. Today we're talking with two chefs who make dishes that are much tastier and more sophisticated than that. Jen Lin Liu, who lives in Beijing and wrote a book about the history of the noodle from China to Italy and beyond, and Martin Yan, who's helping describe what his executive chef Tony Wu does at their MY China restaurant in San Francisco.
I think Chef Tony is ready to make one strand of noodle into 16,000 strands of noodle. And let us check it out with Chef Tony.
Again, I know you can't see what's happening, so let me describe it to you. Chef Tony has taken a lump of raw dough, just flour and water, and he's twisted and turned it, stretching it out like a jump rope, and then twisting it back together again, multiple times so that the dough is nice and stretchy and looks like one very long, thick, twisted noodle. Now, in front of a long counter that's got a good, thick layer of flour spread across the top of it, he takes this long dough piece in two hands and stretches out his arms. He swings the dough up and down so it bends and stretches out. It really does kind of look like a jump rope.
Now, look at that. You have one strand of noodle, and Chef Tony would twist it. Now, one strand of noodle, he fold it. He stretch it, and you fold it.
This time, instead of twisting it back together, he coats it in flour so the noodles won't stick to themselves. And then he puts the two ends together in one hand and grabs the middle, stretching it out again.
By senses, by feeling, then you have two. And then you feel it, and you fold it again. You have four strands of noodle. And then you fold it again. You have eight strands of noodle. And then you fold it again. You have 16 strands of noodle.
So each time Chef Tony stretches out the dough, he puts the two ends in one hand and grabs the bottom of this loop of noodle, stretching all of these noodle pieces out again and making sure they don't stick together by kind of dipping them in the flour. And yes, he's blindfolded, which just adds to the excitement. He does this again and again, each time doubling the number of noodle strands in his hands.
And then you fold it again. You see, he's doing it by senses, by feeling, touching it. And then 4,000 strands of noodle. And then you fold it again. 8,000 strands of noodle. And then fold it again. You have 16,000 strands of noodle, totally done by hand. Look at that. World record. We've never seen anything like that. This is a human pasta machine. Chef Tony Wu of MY China in San Francisco. Look at that. Look at this. Ah, look at that. This is handmade noodle. It is so small, like hair. This is a true master, the best.
That was exciting. If you want to actually see what that looked like, go to butwhykids.org or to our But Why Kids Facebook page, where we have the video of Chef Tony pulling the noodles. Making 16,000 very thin noodle strands by hand in 2 minutes obviously takes a lot of skill. Food writer and cooking school owner Jen Lin Liu says even though pasta has just 2 or 3 ingredients, making good pasta takes practice, whether you're doing it by hand or shaping your noodles with a machine.
Oh, absolutely. You really have to do it on a regular basis to be good at noodles. There's a kind of noodle in China called the knife-grated flying noodle, where you have a mound of dough in your hand and a razor blade-looking kind of knife that you use to slice the noodles, like long strands, directly into a hot boiling wok of water. There's also a kind of noodle called hand pulled noodles.
That's what Tony Wu just did.
That takes a lot of artistry. It looks like, you know, a man almost like, you know, pulling apart, you know, using his hands like an accordion to stretch long strands of noodles. And then they kind of break them off with their wrist and then throw them into another hot wok of boiling water. There's a lot of artistry and talent that goes into making noodles.
Some of the filled pasta, like ravioli and tortellini and shumai, also take a ton of practice to get right. So making noodles isn't as easy as throwing flour and water together and calling them done. But making noodles can be really fun, and it can be a way to bring your family together around a shared activity and something that you love to eat, and a more interesting way to create your own dinner. And once you've got the noodles down, Martin Yan says the possibilities are endless.
You can make noodle soup, you can stir-fry noodle, you can deep-fry the noodle, you can make just like anything else. Just like you can make chow mein, you can make wonton noodle, you can make all kinds. You can make wonton, 2-ton, or 3 tons. You know, the Chinese famous recipe is wonton noodles. So all of your children, you can make many tons.
You know what? That was a noodle joke and a math joke combined. Wonton, spelled W-O-N-T-O-N. But it sounds like one ton, like a ton of noodles, a ton of bricks. Get it? Wonton? One ton? 2 ton? 3 ton? I don't know. Maybe only Martin Yan can make a noodle joke. At any rate, I hope you have fun eating and maybe making your own noodles. Let us know how it goes. Don't forget to check out the noodle pulling video on our Facebook page or at butwhykids.org. I'm Jane Lindholm, and you're listening to But Why, a podcast for curious kids from Vermont Public Radio. You can normally find us wherever you get your podcasts, but today we're bringing the podcast to the airwaves. Our show takes questions from kids and finds answers. If the kids in your life have a question, record it and send it to questions@butwhykids.org. Sometimes your questions are easily answered by someone with just the right knowledge. They are questions with fact-based answers, like why are some eggs brown and some white or green or blue? We've tackled that question and the answer is really interesting. But sometimes your questions don't have precise answers. Sometimes there are many answers, or none even. Sometimes we need to find people who can offer you advice or their opinion or maybe just a new perspective. That's the kind of question and topic we're tackling today. A lot of you have been sending us questions about something that makes you scared.
My name is Scout. I am 8 years old. I live in Ayer, Massachusetts. My question is, why do things seem more scary in the dark, even though they are the same things you see when it's light? Bye!
My name is Logan from Jericho, Vermont. I'm 5 years old. And my question is, why do people have fear of the dark?
Hi, my name is Izzy, and I'm 2 years old, and I live in Santa Cruz, California. Why am I so scared of the dark?
See what I mean? That's a tricky thing to answer. So we're going to tackle this in two ways today. Later in the episode, we'll go for a hike in the dark with a wildlife biologist to get a sense of the things you can learn from going out into the darkness and to answer non-scary questions about how animals see at night. But first, we thought we'd talk to someone who not only shared the fear of the dark that some of you have when he was a child, but who has embraced fear and made writing scary books his job.
I am Daniel Handler. I am best known for books that I write under the name Lemony Snicket, specifically the 13 volumes in a series of unfortunate events.
You also wrote a book, a really lovely picture book, about a fear of the dark.
I did, yes. I think it's fun to write picture books about things we might otherwise be afraid of. So I've written a picture book about words. My most recent picture book is about a swarm of bees. And then there is The Dark, which is about being afraid of the dark.
So let's tackle some of the questions that our listeners have for you here and about their own existential fear of the dark.
Certainly.
Hello, my name is Truman, and I live in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
My name is Donnelly. I live in St. Johnsbury, Vermont.
My name is Sydney. I live in Skokie.
And I want to know why people are scared of the dark.
Why are some people afraid of the dark?
Why are some people afraid of the dark?
The question that everybody has is, why? Why are we afraid of the dark?
And I think the short answer is because the dark is terrifying.
Oh, good. Thanks for putting us at ease.
Yes. For most of us, our visual sense is very important to us. And when that visual sense is taken away, it can be extremely disorienting. And so if we're used to seeing something and measuring our way through the world physically and emotionally with the blessing of sight, which most of us are lucky enough to have in one form or another, it being taken away is very terrifying. And also it allows the brain to wander, and then your brain wanders to things that might not otherwise occur to you. So if you're walking through your house in the daytime, you don't think to yourself, I wonder if someone has somehow let an alligator in that is underneath the sofa and it's waiting to get me. You would never think that at high noon. But in the middle of the night, if you wake up and you need a glass of water or the opposite, the first thing that will occur to you is, I wonder what horrible beast has somehow very silently gotten its way into my otherwise harmless home.
That example sprang to mind awfully quickly. Maybe you have had similar fears yourself?
Of course, yes. I have a creaky wooden floor near where I sleep. And when I walk on it in the middle of the night, I can assume that the creaks are covering up the talons or the smacking of lips or something else that some terrible creature is grateful for the camouflage.
Well, so if that's where our minds go, or some of us find that our minds go there in the darkness, how do we deal with that? Because we can't eliminate the dark. In fact, we don't want to. The dark is really important. But so how do we address or deal with or come to live with our fear?
Well, I think the thing with living with fear is like living with anyone you know, which is that you have to resign yourself to the fact that it lives there. You have to spend some time with it. You have to avoid getting into arguments with it and see how that works. That's how I feel about fear. So there's no conquering of fear. There's no banishing of it. There's only kind of letting it live where it lives and then leaving it alone when it's frightening you.
How do you leave it alone when it's frightening you? That's the hardest part for me.
Well, it really depends on what kind of fear we're talking about and what the circumstances are. I mean, if you wanted to give me a more specific example, I could probably give you a specific prescription. But in general, I find when I'm afraid, rather than telling myself not to be afraid, I think to myself, okay, I'm afraid. This is the time when I'm experiencing fear. Let me live in this fearsome state for a little bit and see if it passes. And then it usually does. Or as I tell myself, if it doesn't, that will be the least of my problems.
You know, one of the problems, too, is that a lot of adults will tell kids, don't worry, don't be afraid, there's nothing there, go back to sleep, you're being
yes.
silly. And that doesn't seem to help, because when you're afraid, somebody telling you, don't be stupid, just doesn't make you feel any better.
Right. And it's very shameful for adults because young children haven't experienced that much culture, but almost every adult has seen some version of a fearful story. They've read it or they've watched it on a screen in which something terrible is happening and other people don't believe that something terrible is happening. I mean, that's pretty standard for the genre, right? Oh, you kids, I'm not going down to the cemetery. I know very well there are no werewolves. That's in a werewolf movie. I heard a mysterious noise outside and I think I'll go out in my nightgown with this lantern and see what it is because it's probably nothing. And so when adults say, there's absolutely nothing under the bed, I won't even check for you, that's just very offensive to me.
So what should kids do, though, if that's what the adults are telling them? You know, you can't say, no, Mom, get on your hands and knees and get under the bed and check.
Well, on the contrary, I think you can say calmly, I absolutely insist that you do this basic parental chore for me. And if you have trouble articulating it that way in the middle of the night because you're afraid, when you wake up in the daytime, let your mind wander, as everyone's mind wanders, to your terrible parents and all of the things that they've done wrong. And then you can write a note, if you're able to write, or otherwise convey to your parents, this is a very basic duty. When I'm afraid in the middle of the night, it is your job to help me.
How did you deal with what you were afraid of as a kid when you were not afraid of the darkness itself necessarily, but as you've told some other interviews, afraid of the things that might be in the dark?
Right, things that are in the dark. I mean, I think that's a more common association of the dark. Very few people look into the inside of their shoes and become frightened by the darkness that's there.
Well, I don't know. You've just given us all an idea now.
Exactly. But what would you be afraid of most in the darkness of your shoe? Everybody knows this, a scorpion.
Right.
Scorpions love to live in your shoe. There's probably at least four in a pair of shoes that you're not using right now. And someday you will put your foot in there and learn too late that it's there.
Oh, great.
I mean, again, it should be emphasized that by then you will not be worrying about your fear. You won't be afraid of a scorpion anymore. You'll be afraid of death, which is far supersedes the fear of a scorpion.
Wait a minute. Now we're getting sidetracked. I asked you how you dealt with your fear of the things in the dark.
I would say that I dealt with my fear by thinking about it all of the time and letting it consume me and really give me a whole lot of trouble. And then every so often it would pass. So I wholeheartedly recommend that method. I wrote a lot of stories about terrible things that happened to people based on my own fears. I came up with plans that I would never be able to enact in real life, probably, about what I might do in various fearsome situations. And I told everybody how afraid I was of things. I do think that often saying out loud what you are afraid of tends to lessen the fear. Because sometimes what you're afraid of is ridiculous. Not very often, but sometimes it is. And so if you say it out loud, suddenly you have said a ridiculous sentence out loud and it makes you laugh and become less afraid.
And if it doesn't feel ridiculous, is it still a good exercise to say it out loud, maybe to somebody you trust?
I think so, yes. I think when you keep it inside you, it bounces around and has nowhere else to go. So if you can't bring yourself to say it to someone, you can write it down. You can hum it to yourself. You can draw a picture of it. I think letting it outside of your brain is always good.
Now, you know, sometimes, as you and I know, and as a lot of people know, a lot of kids know, being afraid can be kind of delicious. It can be appealing. It can make the hairs on the back of your neck rise up in a fun way. But there's a difference between a fear that's kind of fun and a fear that's not fun, a fear that's not based on an active imagination, but based on something that actually might be really dangerous to you or something going on in your life that is not good for you. So how should you talk to people when you think you have a fear that is not a delicious, fun, scary fear, but an actual problem for you?
Well, I think the two kinds of fear that you're talking about are often hard to tell apart. Oftentimes when you really ought to be afraid of something, you're telling yourself that you ought not to be, which is the same thing you're telling yourself when you're afraid of something that you ought not to be. So I think it can actually be very confusing along those lines. What I would recommend is talking about it the same way, whether you're afraid of something that seems unlikely or whether you're afraid of something that seems likely. The worst thing that you can do for your fear is nothing. The best thing that you could do is to live through it in some way and to express it. Let it live outside of your brain. And I think oftentimes if you talk about your fears, you If it's a delicious fear, it's like something else delicious, that if you share it with other people, everybody's having a good time. And if it's not a delicious fear, like anything else that is not delicious, if you give it to other people, then there's less for yourself.
So while we're talking about the dark, is there anything else that you think we should know and we should be thinking about? Because some of the people who've sent us these questions are liking this fear and some are not.
Yeah, well, it's very hard. I mean, I think it's difficult to figure out whether you're really liking being afraid or not. I think that's a difficult category to discern. But what I think with the dark is that it is always dark someplace. And so a nice thing to think after you've had a terrifying night and then it is daytime and you're feeling a little better is you know that the dark has moved on to bother somebody else. And there's something about the idea that all of these fears and all of these negative experiences, as well as all of the positive experiences, whether these are specific experiences like a swarm of bees or fear, or whether they are positive experiences like a banana split or joy, that everyone is taking turns having them. So it's just your turn to be afraid sometimes when something has occurred to you. And if you talk about it, and if you let it out of your brain in some way, other people get a little bit of it and you're beginning to share it, and then it will go away and it will move on to someone else.
Well, I appreciate that perspective because it's not telling us just to forget about it, that we're being silly.
No.
But it's telling us there's a way you can live through this.
I mean, fear is something that absolutely everybody has felt from time to time. You know, sometimes when you're walking and you see someone who is crying deeply, who's just having a terrible time, and your heart goes out to them because you remember when you've had a terrible time like that, and it isn't your time to have a terrible time right then when you're watching it. And fear is like that. Everyone has been afraid out of their minds at one time or another.
That was Daniel Handler. He's the author known as Lemony Snicket. Older kids might know his Series of Unfortunate Events chapter books, and younger kids might know his picture book, The Dark, illustrated by John Klassen. And he has a new picture book that deals with anger called Swarm of Bees. Thanks to Daniel for being willing to answer some questions for us in today's show. This is But Why, a podcast for curious kids. I'm Jane Lindholm, and today we're talking all about the dark and why some of us are afraid of it. But you know, the darkness doesn't have to be scary. It's also magical and really important. The darkness lets us sleep peacefully. For other animals, it's when they wake up. Canada geese and other migratory birds fly long distances at night when the air is cooler and often a little bit more still, and it's less stressful for them to fly. Many plants, too, are hard at work at night so that during the day they can conserve moisture.
Hi, this is Riley. I live in Hokesson, Delaware, and my question is, why does it get so dark at night?
Hi, my name is Hayden, and I'm 8 years old, and I live in Amherst, New Hampshire, and my question is, why does it turn dark at night?
It gets dark because the sun is on the other side of the Earth. You know how the Earth rotates around the sun? It takes a year for that to happen. But the Earth is also spinning right around on its own axis, and it makes a complete turn every 24 hours. So when it's nighttime in Delaware, where Charlie is, that's because your part of the world, Delaware, is facing away from the sun. The sun's light can't get to where you are. And as the world spins, it spins back toward the face of the sun, and you experience that as sunrise. Since the sun is our main source of light, when we aren't in the path of it, we experience darkness. And we typically call darkness night. Now, when the moon is out, you can also get light from the moon. That's the sunlight reflecting off the surface of the moon and back down onto the Earth. And sometimes moonlight gives you a lot of light, even at night. But I digress. Some of you want to know about those animals that are active at night and how they can see so well in the darkness. So to answer your questions, I thought it might be fun to actually go out on a nighttime walk with someone who can help us understand.
My name's Steve Perrin. I'm work for the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department as a rare species biologist, and we're in Hinesburg on some wooded trails near Lewis Creek.
Not quite dark yet, but overcast night, so getting pretty dark.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to be in unfamiliar territory right now.
Hi, my name is Dylan. I'm 4 years old. I live in Maryland, and my question is, how do you see in the dark?
Can you describe how we see in the dark and how well or not well we see in the dark compared to other animals?
Sure. It's really the same process for people as it is for animals. Our pupils, the dark center of our eyes, is where the light enters. And at night, our pupils dilate. They get wider. They allow more light to come in. And, you know, if you walk outside at night, initially you don't really see very much, but if you wait a few minutes, your eyes dilate and you start to notice some features. Not like daytime, but you certainly start to see more.
One thing Steve does to try to help his eyes and his brain adjust to darkness is to make sure he doesn't turn on a flashlight unless he absolutely has to. That way, his pupils, the little black center of your eye, stay as wide as possible to take in as much light as they can.
So animals, they do the same thing, except they're better at it.
And they're better at it because their eyes are better for this?
Some animals are actually adapted so they can see better at night.
My name's Harlan. I live in Aspen, Colorado, and I am 4. And my question is, how do cats see in the dark?
Steve says cats' eyes are a little different than ours. Their pupil, that's the little black dot in the center of your eyeball, is different in cats than it is in humans. In humans, it's round. In cats, it's not.
They have a vertical split pupil. That split pupil actually adjusts more quickly to changes in light. In a cat's eye, they can actually open up the pupil so it covers the entire surface.
Really?
Yeah, so if you see a cat at night, shine a light at them, you'll just see a black eye looking back at you.
So does that go for all cats? They all have that vertical sort of slit pupil, and they can all open their pupil up to see really well at night?
Yes. You know, there's other adaptations, like happened to have had a bobcat in the yard the other day and got a really good look at the back of the ears. Nice white spot on the back of each ear. And that's thought to help family groups stay together at night.
Oh, because they can see that white spot.
They can see mom's white spot behind her ears.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That enlarged pupil lets the cat's eye bring in more light so the cat can see more. Not exactly like a flashlight where you can only see what's right in front of the beam of light. More like how you can see a lot more of the world around you on that moonlit night than on a cloudy night or when the moon isn't out. But you know, when you think about animals in the darkness, you might be picturing the glowing eyes staring back at you. And Abigail wants to know how that works.
I'm 6 years old. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. And my question is, why do raccoons and cats' eyes glow in the dark?
That's because of a structure in the eye that actually reflects the light that enters. And so it allows the image to be seen twice, which enhances the night vision. But that same structure reflects light back out. So that's the eye shine that you see at night.
So we've stopped now, and we're here in the darkness, and we can listen for a minute. If we were to see an animal coming, could we tell what it is by looking at the way its eyes look at night or the way they glow?
It would help, but I wouldn't bet the farm because some of the animals' eyes are the same color. They're yellowish, say. Mm-hmm. So there's a few different animals, but you know, there's other clues you would look for, like how far apart are the eyes? How is the animal moving? Is it staring right at you or is it looking aside? You know, the animals have different behaviors and sizes and stuff. So you kind of need to put it all together. And your brain tells you that, oh, that's a so-and-so. It may or may not be true.
Yeah. You did tell me, though, that if you see red eyes, that you need to be worried about.
There's different animals that have red eyes, but one of the animals is a bear. The one you really want to know is that if you're at a lake and you see red eyes in the water, it's most likely an alligator. And that's a good one to know.
Get out.
Yeah, don't go swimming.
So one of the other things about being out at night that is so hard to get over is because you can't see, it's hard to know what's out there. And so, I mean, you've probably had the experience that I have of being out in the middle of darkness and hearing a sound and thinking, I think that's a deer or I think that's a bear. And then it gets light and gets light and you realize that was a squirrel and yep, it's making all this noise. But your mind goes to this sort of big, scary place because you can't see it.
Right. Well, we're here in Vermont and there's really nothing big and scary out there that's really worrying some to an adult.
Even a bear.
Even a bear. Most bears are pretty well behaved in Vermont. For the most part, there's nothing that really makes me feel like a prey animal. But that could be part of our fear of darkness, could have been built into our evolution where we were prey at one point.
Yeah, it's not silly to be afraid of the dark.
I don't think so. There's more risks. And there's been studies done that it's better to make the mistake of being overly cautious than to not be cautious and come to a bad end. So,
one of the things that you can do is learn more about what might be out around you and what might be out at night, because then if you understand how an animal moves, for example, you might be able to say, oh, that's probably my house cat.
Sure. And, you know, animals make noises at night, you know, and some of them are surprising. It took me a long time to kind of get a sense of what a fox sounds like at night. Yeah, I mean, they're unfamiliar noises, you know. I'm not used to talking to foxes, you know, and it takes sometimes a long time to have that experience and to know that it actually came from a fox.
Well, a fox in particular, that sound is terrifying.
It can be if you don't know what it is. I mean, it's just like everything else. If you don't know what it is, then you start getting worried and stuff.
What might know that we're here right now that we don't know is listening to us?
Well, deer, you know, they could be in the woods right here with us. Flying squirrels could be up in the trees. There could be some napping red squirrels or gray squirrels that are kind of wondering why we're disturbing their slumber. There's birds have come back now on migration. There's probably some birds around. Uh-huh. Probably red-backed voles in the woods and white-footed mice, you know. Could be weasels around on their nightly forays. So there could be a lot of stuff out there.
I've heard coyotes around here sometimes.
Yeah, we've got a bunch of coyotes, and they're kind of a social animal. And at night, you'll hear them yipping sometimes, and that's how they keep in contact. And it can be over long distances. And then sometimes when you hear what's sometimes referred to as a chorus, it's like they've met up. There's a group of them, you know, and they can be making quite a ruckus. And, you know, on a few occasions I've gone to the site where I thought I had heard them during the night. And, yeah, the ground's all torn up and they were having a party.
What about owls? I was hoping we might hear some barred owls here tonight.
Owls are nighttime creatures. They're really good at it. They have eyes that are really adapted for seeing at night. They're actually a different shaped eye than everybody else. You know, our eyes are round, but owls are more tubular, and it helps them gather light.
I think it's amazing that they can fly through all of these great big pines following the prey and not hit a tree. And, you know exactly where they're going.
So animals make mistakes, you know, unfortunately they hit power lines, and they do. If the wind changes, they can get blown into stuff. But, you know, with experience, and probably they know their woods, they know the individual trees and the pathways and stuff. So that's all part of it.
You think they have their own trails through the sky?
I suspect so. And that, as a young animal, it's like learning to ride a bicycle. You fall once in a while.
Huh. Want to walk up to the peeper pond and then we can turn around?
Sure. So this is really nice because you have a kind of an open skylight. You kind of have there's a gradient of light that you can follow.
Yeah, it's easy to see.
And what I learned to do when I lived in the woods was I didn't focus right ahead of me. I let my peripheral vision see the larger area, and that would kind of tell me where the path was.
Mm-hmm. Did that take practice?
It did.
Can you identify more than one kind of frog here that we're listening to? Because those loud, familiar ones are the peepers.
Right. I'm hearing mostly peepers. I was wondering if I might be hearing a different trill, but I can't be sure. Peepers are hard because they drowned out other noises. So some of the frogs make snoring noises, and that's what I thought I might hear. Pickerel frog was a possibility here. Might hear leopard frogs. They make a nice snoring sound.
Shall we wander back?
Sure.
So do you have any advice for kids who do find themselves afraid of the dark? And a lot of the dark fears are not necessarily being out in the wilderness in the dark, but, you know, just ways to think about darkness that might help us at least appreciate it.
I can only talk about my own experiences, but I started going out in the dark and learning to trust my senses, build up a little confidence. Nothing bad happened.
No alligators.
Right. And I just became more comfortable over time. I don't know if it's a game that I play with myself, but I try to navigate in the dark in my own house. I don't turn on lights often. You know, I'm pretty familiar with the house and the rooms, and you can touch walls and things, and I just find it interesting that, you know, you don't have to rely on your eyes all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And even when you are using your eyes, you have these other senses that are kind of giving you feedback too. So,
including putting your hands out.
Yeah.
Which is what I'm tempted to do now.
Steve and I walked back to the start of the trail, the trailhead, where I had parked my car in the darkness. We did have to turn on my flashlight at one point because we realized we were going off the trail and we didn't know where we were, so we wanted to make sure we could get back on the trail. And another time we ran into a tree that had fallen down on the trail, but we kind of put our hands out first, like I was just talking about, so we didn't get hurt. It was neat to walk in the darkness and to trust my other senses a little more than I otherwise might. To pay attention to the feel of the ground underneath my feet. It was really packed down where the trail was, and a kind of smushier, softer off the trail. Once you start paying attention to that, you can kind of walk the trail by feel without even having to see it. I could focus on the smell of the forest around me. I could tell when there were patches of cold air and patches of warm air because I was paying more attention to other things, and I got to listen to the noises of the frogs and the rustling leaves. You might want to try what Steve suggested. See if you can navigate around your bedroom or your house in the darkness sometime. Now, make sure you're in a safe place, not near the stairs or anything that could make you fall and hurt yourself. You should probably tell the adult in your life you're going to do that first, just so they know what you're doing in that darkness. Or if you live in a place where there aren't streetlights, you could go outside and see what it's like to let your eyes get used to the dark. See what you can hear and smell and feel in your own backyard when it's really dark. You've been listening to a special hour of But Why? A podcast for curious kids. If you like what you've heard, be sure to find us and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. We have more than 100 episodes ready for you to listen to right now, and new ones come out every other Friday. If you want to learn more about how to listen to podcasts in the first place, you can check out VPR's Beginner's Guide to Podcasts at vpr.org. And if the kids in your life have a question for But Why?, adults can record them asking their question on a smartphone or tablet using free apps like Voice Memos or Voice Recorder. Then you can email the file to questions@butwhykids.org. We can't answer every question we get, but we love hearing what kids are thinking and wondering about. But Why is produced by Melody Baudette and me, Jane Lindholm, at Vermont Public Radio. Our theme music is by Luke Reynolds. You can find us anytime at butwhykids.org. Stay curious.